from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in this morning's opening hour, we'll spend the first half hour with veteran political analyst David Gergen, who was advisor to four presidents and presently directs public leadership at Harvard's Kennedy School. And we'll discuss, among other topics, the Obama presidency in its second term and the future of the Republican Party. Then we take up the lawsuit in a trial which began earlier this week, which sees 10 California cities and counties suing paint manufacturers for nearly $1 billion. Forum is next. Join us for the hour here on KQED Public Radio. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. During a 2012 campaign speech, President Barack Obama said his reelection would break the fever of partisan fighting that was keeping the Capitol at a standstill. But deep into President Obama's second term, Congress is still deadlocked, and political commentator David Gergen says the public has lost interest in the Obama White House. The four-time presidential advisor and senior political analyst for CNN, David Gergen also heads the Harvard Kennedy School Public Leadership Program, and he served as editor-at-large for U.S. News and World Report, as he says, back in the days of print. He joins us for this opening half-hour segment to discuss the current state of national politics and the future of the Republican Party, a number of other important issues. And welcome, David Gergen. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Michael. Good morning.
Pleased to have you here. And I guess the place to begin is with this whole question of, has the fever broken in terms of the promise that the president made that he was going to do something about partisan fighting with all the charm offensive and the like? We're still deadlocked, although we did, and I want to mention this because it's important news and it's current. We did see an agreement just yesterday on lowering the interest rate on student loans. But this is a president who said change will come to America, and then in the second campaign said change will come to bipartisanship.
He did, and it's most unfortunate for the country, I think, to be fair to everyone involved. Normally, a president elected to a second term has about a year to a year and a half to govern domestically, get big things done. And then the midterm elections come along and focus changes. And after the midterm elections, people are looking over the incumbent president's shoulder toward his successor. But you normally have that window of a year to 18 months. And unfortunately, that has not happened with this president. The window never really opened after the elections. He thought the partisan fever, he said it would break, but it hasn't. The Republicans remain, I think, as obdurate and resistant to most of the big ideas. He wanted to have an immigration bill done by August. That's not going to happen. It's an uphill fight now in the House. He wanted to have a big deal done on the debt ceiling or on debt. That's not going to be done. A Bowles-Simpson deal is not going to be done. He obviously wanted a big gun control bill. That failed. So he's had a hard time with this. I think a lot of it is due to the partisan nature of Congress today, the divisions there. Some is due to his own governing style. But the point for the country is that I think the wind has gone out of his sails as president here at home. That's not to say he can't regain momentum. It's gone out so early that maybe there's a possibility he'll find his way here soon. Ronald Reagan had a couple of tough years just after he was reelected, but came back and did a lot of big things. And maybe President Obama can regain the initiative. But it is noticeable, I think, how many Americans have turned away from Washington, because the story is, one of paralysis, and after a while that becomes boring. And so you look at the cable shows and how they went for the Zimmerman trial. They really focused on it. They put it on, wall to wall. That's because there was nothing else to compete with it coming out of Washington.
You think, though, that this has to do sometimes with what's called the second-term blues? I mean, a president doesn't have to seek reelection because of constitutional amendment that he can't. And in the case of President Obama, there have been scandals, and there often are in second administrations, it seems.
Yes, sir. And he's never had a Watergate, thank goodness. But he's had some many scandals. The IRS one, I think, was particularly troublesome to many Americans. And there's been a series of diversions that he had not expected. A lot of surprises. The Snowden case, for example, who could have predicted that would sweep in the way it has? But even when he's had the microphone, as in his trip to Africa, that would have, you know, Barack Obama going back to Africa in this big way, that normally would have gotten a fair amount of attention. It got very modest attention. He was competing in part with the Mandela story. But I think the overall point is that not only is there paralysis in Washington, but the country has stepped back from it. The interest in politics is low. You talk to anybody in the media today and they say people just don't particularly want to hear about politics right now. They're interested in other subjects. It will return. I also think the Hillary factor is there. You know, it's not as if there's an open field on the Democratic side. There's an awful lot of sort of waiting for Hillary going on among
Democrats. An awful lot on the other side of making a big deal out of Benghazi to try to assert.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
But I'm also wondering, the big question here is that we have gridlock because of all of the Republican obstruction to a great degree, obviously, and their own party schisms with the Tea Party on the one hand, the holding Boehner back and all. Or how much of this, I mean, you said some, but how much of this is Obama's lack of leadership?
Well,
I mean, it's not like LBJ, like he's pulling strings.
I think, first of all, to be fair to the president, the country's divided. It's not just that there's division in Washington. The blue districts are getting bluer and red districts are getting redder. And, you know, at the grassroots level, there's just an awful lot of division. People often now actually choose a home depending on the political coloration of the neighborhood into which they're moving. They want to be around people like them. And that is added to this pressure. There's very little support among voters for candidates who are the statesmen of the past, who would, you know, reached across the aisle and made agreements. So I think it's very fundamentally the country is suffering a lot of divisions. We've never had, you know, the difference between Republican support of Obama versus Democratic support of Obama is like 79% difference, and that's a huge gap. Now, as to the president's governing style, I think he's suffering in part. I look at this through a media lens probably because that's where I spent a lot of my life. I think he's suffering in part because he was overexposed in the first term. He was out there too much. Mm. And, you know, and we have a tendency, even with the best television shows, even Bill Cosby couldn't hold an audience eventually. And Barack Obama is having a hard time holding an audience. You know, the numbers for his various speeches has gone down. If you look at his primetime speeches, he's not even giving primetime speeches. I think he ought to give a primetime press conference to sort of regain the sense of a forward motion. He's also caught with something else, Michael. I've never seen this in a president before. He's got this dilemma that if he gets out in front on an issue such as immigration, it automatically poisons the well for any kind of agreement in Congress. Mm. It automatically generates opposition. So if he gets out in front and leads in a way a president normally leads, he has trouble. But if he does it the other way, if he's more passive, if he tries to do it from behind the scenes, he's seen as not leading. You know, so it's very awkward for him, and I don't.
It's a catch 22.
It's a catch 22. Exactly right, and I think in part this is due not only to the resistance from Republicans, but I think his style is that of a person who is. I have enormously high personal regard for President Obama. He's a man of integrity. He's a very smart fellow. I really want him to succeed. As a former White House person, I like presidents to succeed. But his style is that of he's much more introspective, and he's much more, you know, he's a little shyer. He doesn't like the give and take, the banging in the arena that, you know, a Teddy Roosevelt
will
relish.
A Clinton or a W. Schmoozer at all.
He's not. And if you look at the people who've gotten the big legislation done, whether it's Franklin Roosevelt or Lyndon Johnson or Bill Clinton or Ronald Reagan, what characterized all of them was they love politics. They love the arena. They love to be down there, working with, arguing against, having drinks late at night with, talking on the phone with members of Congress. You know, Lyndon Johnson was famous for calling up Ev Dirksen, who was a Republican leader, almost every day at 5 o'clock, and they'd talk for half an hour to find out what was going on. And that's how Lyndon Johnson got the civil rights bills done in 64 and 65. He called on Everett Dirksen, his friend, that he developed his relationship with. This president does not have those kind of relationships, I'm sad to say.
Well, in fact, quite the contrary. You think about Mitch McConnell saying the one thing we need to do as Republicans is ensure that President Obama not be reelected.
Absolutely. That comes from the Republican side. So this is not all Obama. It's not fair to say this is all Obama, but his style does not lend itself to the kind of give and take and the kind of mutual respect that, say, you know, Bill Clinton had You know, he had huge hostile opposition in a Republican Congress. Hell, they impeached him. But he still got deals worked out with Newt Gingrich. They're both political to their fingertips. He got a deal worked out on welfare reform. He got four straight balanced budgets in his second term.
Talking to David Gergen, veteran political analyst, and also now head of the public leadership school, which is part of the Kennedy School, excuse me, at Harvard University.
I just have a center. I'm a co-director with a fellow named Max Baserman, who's a wonderful partner.
Let me actually invite listeners to join us. In fact, opportunity for you to talk to one of our leading political commentators and political analysts. You can join us toll-free, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite. We do welcome your involvement in the program. It's live and interactive, and the number for you to call is 866-733-6786. Again, that's toll-free from anywhere, 866-733-6786, particularly if you have thoughts about the second term of President Obama and whether or not it's lost its mobility or the president has lost his ability to stir people, inspire people, maybe even get people interested and get them galvanized and cross over these bipartisan lines. You can also join us and join the conversation by going to our website, kqed.org, or our Facebook page, or email us, forum@kqed.org. We had Jeffrey Toobin on recently, David Gergen, and he was saying the most powerful political person in the United States now is John Roberts. He's setting the political agenda. And in fact, it's not only that he's responsible for all the judges' appointments on FISA, it's also the fact that you look at the Supreme Court decisions recently, and I think you were saying, well, DOMA was to one side and then Texas was to another side, playing it politically very careful in some ways, but also making sure that kind of a conservative agenda is followed.
Well, he is very powerful. I would not call him the most powerful. I think that title probably goes to Ben Bernanke at the Federal Reserve, whose interest rates and the buying of bonds, of course, is having such a big influence on the economy. But even so, John Roberts is extremely powerful. It's a divided court with Justice Kennedy in the middle as a swing vote. And I think we saw most clearly how Roberts is trying to he's obviously conservative, but he's also, as Chief Justice, has the interests of the institution of the Supreme Court very much in mind. And we saw that in particular on the decision on affordable health care, when he made the decision that alienated so many conservatives, but did it, I think, in part to protect the reputation of the court.
It also did it on a Commerce Clause, which will afford the opportunity to do more conservative things in the future.
It will, but that was not the most serious impact of the case as such. Had that court case been decided 5-4 against Obamacare, declaring it unconstitutional, we would have had one heck of a big row in this country saying this, with people arguing the Supreme Court has gotten to be very, very political, and it's deciding things on an ideological basis. That's not the first time.
Well, forgive me, especially after Bush v. Gore and Citizens
sure.
United.
Sure. But you and I are old enough, Michael, to remember there was a time that the conservatives argued that about the Warren Court, just the other way around. It's a liberal court. It's not looking at the law. It's looking at results. So the shoe is now on the other foot. And I think that the argument can be made that there's a liberal bloc on the court, and there's now a conservative bloc on the court, of which Roberts is not the intellectual leader, but he's certainly a member of that group. You know, Scalia's got more intellectual, I think, leadership in that group. But I wouldn't say that Roberts is running the country in any sense. He's still got to get Kennedy's vote.
Let me ask you about one other thing, because I want to bring callers into this and get the listeners involved. But you gave a talk at the press club, I guess it was last month, and you said the Obama administration was allowing leak investigators to pry into journalists' work and
yep.
even label them criminals. And I think you were pretty hot under the collar about this.
Yeah. I was. I think it's this goes back. This is pre-Snowden. We're almost talking about another age, aren't we? This goes back to when there were questions of leaks. And leaks are serious. I don't want to minimize national security leaks. Having worked in government and been aware of the damage that's done when leaks occur, the government has to take it very seriously, and they do. This government has taken it very seriously. But in the past, Michael, we have always said it's the leaker – who is criminally responsible, not the leakee. And the leakee is a journalist. And the leakee is, and that person is asking questions of someone in government. And if that person in government decides to give that journalist a document or tell him a secret and the journalist publishes it, we have never in the past, at least in a contemporary history, we have to go all the way back to the Alien Sedition Acts almost to find examples of this. We've never, in the recent past, we've never questioned or put the journalist under a criminal microscope and said, we're going to put you in jail, in effect, as a criminal. And that's what the Holder Justice Department, when they went after a journalist for Fox News, when they filed the affidavit, they talked about him being part of a criminal conspiracy. Now, they've backed away from that since then.
They said it was just a legal tactic.
Oh, yeah, it was a legal tactic. Thank you very much. They could have put the guy, you know, what they did to this guy and what the ringer they put him through was pretty tough. And, you know, they backed away. I mean, they backed down when all this howling goes on. You can't, at a certain level, you know, it is, look, I was there in Watergate. And if we had treated and I knew Bob Woodward and Bernstein, and you know, I worked inside the administration, inside the White House. And if we had started, you know, if we
you
had
thought
we could treat
younger
them
listeners,
as,
you were a speechwriter for President.
I was running a speechwriting shop there in 73, 74. And that's a long time ago. But the point was, if it would have been unfathomable that we might have ever considered Bob Woodward or Carl Bernstein, whom I think did a service for the country. You know, even though I was on the inside, I was working for Nixon, I must say in retrospect, I think they did a service to the country. And these journalists who were the watchdogs, you know, protect us. And we should not be talking about them as potential criminals.
Our guest, David Begurgin, is professor of public service and director of the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard Kennedy School of Government. He's also senior political analyst for CNN and was an advisor for four presidential administrations, Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton. Let me get some callers on here. We begin with a caller from Burden, New Jersey. Joe, you're on. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Mr. Gergen, I've watched you most of my life. I'm 62. And you just made a statement, and I admire you. I've always seen you as somebody who seems to understand that the truth lies somewhere in the middle, but it's rarely at the edges. And you just made a statement about, you know, Bob Woodward and Mr. Bernstein, and I don't think that there's any comparison whatsoever to the news and the nature of the news and the meaning of the news that they used to do and the investigative reporting they used to do and the kind of reporting that goes on from the likes of stations, you know, like Fox or MSNBC, or even some of the cable nets, the majors, you know, the CNNs of the world and the ABC, NBC, and CBS. I think that the media has, to a large extent, decided that, hey, you know, dissension and polarization sells, and we're gonna set this fire and we're gonna fan these flames all day long. And if you watch any news show, that seems to be all they're doing anymore. Would you comment on your take on the media's responsibility for the division in this country?
It's a very fair question. And let me just say, look, there were some incidents back in the late 60s, early 70s that did involve national security, with the reporters going after national security questions, like the wiretapping that occurred that, you know, President Nixon signed on to and that sort of thing. So I don't think the entire analogy to Woodward and Bernstein is entirely inappropriate. But let's go to your real question, and that is, to what extent does the media bear responsibility? And I think we are we're enablers in too many instances in the media. And that is, we look for guests who are out on the edges, because that makes more interesting television, so to speak, or more interesting magazine writing. Take Olympia Snowe, who just left the Senate, and a wonderful woman, my kind of Republican, someone who works across the aisles, and I think was a very moderate, responsible member of the Senate. And I had conversations with her about this before she left, and she said, look, you know, there were more than once that she got a call from one of the Sunday chat shows saying, would you please come on? Here's the person you're going to be on with on the other side, the Democrat. And they'd call her the next day and said, okay, let's do a pre-interview. After she'd agreed to change her schedule, stay in Washington, do all that. They called her the next day and said, let's have a pre-interview. And they talked to her. And then she would say things about what she wanted to say on the air that would be entirely constructive. It would be, you know, this other senator and I disagree on X, Y, and Z, but I think we can get together and make common cause on A, B, and C. And she would explain how, you know, they could find a solution. And then the next day, somebody would call her back and they'd cancel her. and she turned on that Sunday, and there were a couple of, you know, hotheads in there throwing things at each other. That's what I mean by
what Deborah Tanner called the oppositional culture. I mean, you want that kind of wrestling match.
Well,
or something like that.
You know, but again, not, as you say, sir, the the truth is always elusive and somewhere in between, often in between. You know, why does Fox do that? Why does MSNBC do that? Why does CNN get? I thank goodness CNN doesn't get as drawn in as those others, but they get Fox and MSNBC have got a loyal audiences. They built their audiences. In other words, there's a public appetite for this. So it's not just the networks, but I do think we are unfortunately, in some instances, have been enablers.
And let me thank Joe for his call. I want to get another caller on. Shabazz, good morning.
Good morning. How you doing? As far as President Obama is concerned, I think that it doesn't seem like he's his own person. You know, he doesn't strike me as being, you know, an independent thinker or leader, like he's waiting for, you know, instructions from someone else to run the government the way or deal with issues the way that they seem to do it or want to have it done. You know, that includes the, you know, carrying on a lot of the Bush administration ideas, the drones and these kinds of things, the wiretapping, you know. Mm-hmm. And it also filters down to the news that, you know, Mr. Jergen was just commenting on. It seems like the news have taken the position that instead of reporting the news, they want to shape the news. And it even filters down to the comedy shows, seems like the Lenos and so forth. They're towing the line for the government. Everybody's like doing what the people who tell the president what to do. They're taking that kind of a stance on.
Shabazz, let me hear what David Gergen has to say. Thank you for the call.
Thank you very much for the call. I do think there have been times when President Obama has been cautious. I don't think he's waiting for instructions from anyone, but I do think he's been overly cautious, but give him credit on health care. He put himself out there, put his neck on the line. He took a beating for it, and he's done that on a few other issues. I wish him well. I wish he would be stand up and get out in front on some of these issues, take a strong stand, fight for it in a way presidents have traditionally fought for it, you know, work with members of Congress behind the scenes. And I think the style of leadership, sometimes called leading from behind, so his aides have recently been calling it hidden hand leadership, modeling it after Dwight Eisenhower. But in his case, I think he needs to be more out front. I think he needs to be telling the country where he wants to go. And making a stronger case for what he thinks is in the country's best interest. We cannot continue drifting for much longer.
Well, we've got only a little time left with you, and we're getting a number of emails here and callers waiting to say it's race that's holding him back still.
Is it racism that's holding him back, or is his own race or his perception of race? I you talk to a number of his black constituents, and they cheer him on in public and private. Some of the black constituents feel like he should have done more for the African American community. I must say I'm sympathetic to that argument. I don't think the country has come a long way.
A lot of people are saying because of race, he can't do the bipartisan thing or get the acceptance because of his skin color.
I think just the opposite is the case. I think, and one of the things that a woman's going to be able to do, and thank goodness we'll have a woman one day soon, I hope, in the office, is I think that you go in. If you as a woman, you could have the moral high ground on some of these issues, and I think the press will give you that benefit of the doubt. And when President Obama first came in, his blackness was, I think, an asset for him in governing. I think it helped him in governing. It may have turned a little bit since then, but I think being an African American gives him a certain place in our national life to be able to speak to our consciences, as he spoke in Philadelphia during the 2008 campaign. I thought that was an eloquent speech.
David Gergen, so good to have you with us.
Next time, Michael.
Come back and spend an hour with us.
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you. When we come back, we're going to talk about a billion-dollar lawsuit. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny.